It's been a long journey for writer-director Patrick Reed Johnson and his independent film 52577, a personal recollection of his life as an adolescent who lived, breathed, and dreamed movies. Now, that journey has taken an exciting new direction, and eager fans who have been salivating over the project since it first began production years ago are finally being given an opportunity to experience the film for themselves. Patrick and his team are traveling the country with the film, and a deal with a distributor is imminent. They're also documenting their journey along the way. You can read more about this documentary, their roadshow tour dates, and 52577 at their website, heartsofdorkness.com. In this hour-long conversation, Patrick discusses the origins of his film, his experiences being the first fan to witness Star Wars before the rest of the world, and the struggles and joys associated with bringing his personal vision to the screen and to the people.
Good morning, Mr. and Ms. Warren High School,
and all geeks sitting on top of the bus looking into the girls' locker room.
When I think back on all the crap
you are muffled.
Who the hell is Steven Spielberg?
You're kidding, right?
Do I look like I'm kidding?
Careful.
You're bleeding on Moonbase Alpha.
I still don't get how you think you can get away with making a Jaws 2.
The perfect solution was to shoot it in an insert tank.
It's a swimming pool!
Todd, do you mind?
What do you think, that one of these movies is going to end up being seen by anyone other than you, me, and your mom?
In this scene, decided it's not worth living if he can't live as the alien he really is.
Hi, Beth.
These are your morning announcements for
May 25th, 1977.
A new and golden age lies upon us.
Tennessee Theater, 3 p.m. Come on, gotta go, guys.
Don't be alarmed. It's only Star Wars.
Oh, right, like I'd waste my time on some dorky sci-fi movie.
Oh, so you don't have your little Star Trek parties anymore?
Shut up.
What is this movie about?
I'll hug you now.
I always wished there was a UFO coming to take me back.
So where do you come from?
A distant star system.
Can't get there from here.
Is this not the coolest thing you have ever seen?
There aren't any clicks in the movie theaters. There aren't any chops or geeks or nerds or brains.
This wasn't your first time either. Your first time was the day you saw the coming attraction for Star Wars. You had tears in your eyes.
So?
How could I ever compete with that?
You're gonna go see this movie and everything will be the same. You'll still be Pat Johnson making his little movies in his backyard.
It's not little!
I've just got a big backyard. This has been a long journey for you, and I know it's such a personal movie to you. Tell me what you've kind of discovered about yourself and your film in this process, because it's been years, this process.
It's true. I've discovered that I'm tenacious. And I've discovered, I discovered that I could live something I have long preached, which is, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, never, never, never quit. He didn't actually say that way. It's been watered down, but the idea of never giving up, of just not quitting. That's defeat happens the moment you give up. I mean, you can't quit, and it's kind of Yoda-like too. There is no try, only do, and it's easy enough to say, but after this much time, I've realized no, I can walk that walk. I can actually do it, and I'm proud that I've done it. There are people who called me crazy, people who've called me, delusional, people who've called me a lot of different things, but it really is that I'm just committed to seeing this through, not just to say, oh, it's done, there, I did it, ha ha, I showed you, because it's good, and I believe in it, and I realize that, the shelf life of things in our society anymore is so short, for no good reason other than that we're eternally bored and looking for good stuff. And since we get so little of it, we tend to keep reaching for the next visual snack on the shelf. This is something I've committed a many years of my life to, not just to prove anything, but because I actually believe it's good, and every time I see an audience watch it, I'm proven right.
Right.
You know? And so it's a matter, and many people, you know, it's so easy to say, oh, you know, it doesn't work, or, oh, there must be a problem because it's not finished. Well, there are always problems. There were a multitude of problems associated with the making of this film, but none of the problems had to do with the movie not being good. It had to do with many, many other factors, which we get into in shorter or longer form later. But the movie that's going to come out, and it is going to come out, is a good film, and I'm proud of it. I like to say that I've made a couple of movies before, and this is my first film. I feel like as a director, this is, you know, maybe not just because it was close to my heart, but because I had a really talented and extremely dedicated crew and cast that gave far more than they were paid for and did some really beautiful work that when you clear away the clutter of both wrong expectation and wrong supposition about what it is I'm even making here, once you get to actually sit and watch the film, you can actually see this work and really enjoy it and feel the commitment of these many people that put so much into it.
I love it that you fought as long and hard as you have for your movie, and that just shows me that it's a labor of love, and those are the best movies, the movies that have passion in them. So I mean, I respond to that very much.
Thank you. Well, it is a labor. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just want to know how the dream for you started. I mean, the kind of which this movie kind of explores, but when movies kind of first ignited your imagination as a kid?
I can tell you exactly when it was. It was the day I was, you know, told to get dressed nicely, because in those days you did, to go to a movie and taken to see a little thing called 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I was 6 years old, and I was flabbergasted by what I saw. At first I was just completely confused by the opening sequence with the, you know, the Dawn of Man sequence, and I'm a little frightened, to be honest with you, and also at that point a little bored because I was six, and you know,
yeah.
But at the same time I was fascinated. I was completely fascinated, and then of course all these amazing spaceships showed up, but all I cared about was how did they do that, and how did they do the zero gravity and the upside down walking and the centrifuge and pretty soon by the end of this thing I was just completely mesmerized, to the point where I was also basically asleep for the last 5 minutes. I do remember opening my eyes briefly and seeing a giant baby floating over the earth and saying, and somehow looking, and this thing sort of looking into my eyes and making eye contact with me. And it wasn't saying anything, but in my sort of really, children are so impressionable. And I was an incredibly impressionable child, and I really took it personally that this giant baby floating over the earth was actually looking at me and trying to tell me something.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I came out of that theater, I think as they were carrying me out, I remember kind of mumbling to my mom, I know what I'm going to be when I grow up. And she's like, what's that? And I said, a movie maker. And she said, well, why don't you just get through kindergarten first, and we'll talk about that, you know? And it wasn't too long after that I started stealing my father's movie camera when he was at work, and setting fire to everything I had and blowing things up with firecrackers and, you know, starting my illustrious Super 8 film career.
Mm. Well, let me – this might sound like an odd question, but did you always feel kind of, in retrospect, kind of blessed that you knew automatically what you wanted to be? Because you see a lot of people that – you know, are up there in years, and they still don't know what they ultimately want to do with their life. Is that more of a blessing than a curse that you found?
You know, it's both. The blessing of knowing what you want to do when you're six, and really never, ever, ever changing that or altering that wish, is that the choices you tend to make, especially when you're younger and have a lot of passion and a lot of energy, all are usually in line, hopefully, if you're going to succeed, with what it is you're dreaming of doing. And so you're able to sort of say, oh, no, I'm not going down that road. I'm not going down that path. I'm single-minded. I only need this. I don't need all that clutter, and I certainly don't need to be wasting a lot of time doing what everyone else is doing. You become an iconoclast pretty quick. You sort of become an individual very quickly, especially when you're choosing something that's so kind of out there compared to sort of everyday jobs, you know. I mean, and not that it's better. In fact, in some ways, it's worse. It's hard to find people to relate to and who share that passion when you're in a town of 750 people, you know. And that's a big integral part of the story of 52577. So it's a blessing and a curse all at the same time. The blessing is you can see the path. It's right there. You know what you need to do. The curse is that you also have to walk that path, and if you don't walk it fairly narrowly, you end up straying from it and feeling that you're losing your plot, losing your map, losing your way. And so there are temptations all along the way that are constant. You know, hey, it'd be a lot more fun to just go hang out and party than it would be to work on your script or to work on that edit or to build that model or to, you know, do those storyboards. So there's this battle between... You know, I think if you look at it, and I'll probably get in trouble for this, but the two most successful directors of all time, George and Steven, were, admittedly, I'm not pointing anything out that they wouldn't say themselves, and they haven't said in their own, you know, either autobiographical material, but they were not exactly party animals in high school,
right,
and college.
Right.
You know, they were head down, making movies. That's what they wanted to do, period. I mean, George obviously was playing around with fast cars for a while and got himself in a little trouble with that and quickly got out of it once he only got killed, you know, by wrecking his spider. But George and Steven both, you know, arguably, had they been, you know, party animals in high school, they might not have become the directors they were. They might not have become directors at all. But I think,
you're right.
You know,
yeah.
Geeks and nerds and dorks make great directors because we choose to dream and enact our dreams, even if it makes us look silly in the eyes of those that really aren't comfortable with that kind of nonconformity. And now that being a dork and being a geek is incredibly fashionable, now we've got a whole glut of people who are putting on dorky glasses and dressing in, you know, bowling shirts and, you know, and whatever. I mean, people that are attempting to be dorks and geeks, and some of them are legit, but there's a lot of them out there that are, you know, they really don't have the stuff yet. You know, they just want to be. Yeah, I love that there are wannabe dorks. They want to be geeks. There really are.
Yes, I know. Mean,
you go to Hollywood now, and there's a whole subset of Hollywood, like, development and executive types that are trying desperately to catch up with being true dorks and geeks, you know, and it's kind of funny to watch them because they have no cred at all. They, you know, they haven't seen anything for the first time, you know, and they never stood in line, you know, till 24 hours to watch a movie before, you know. Now they're trying to say, oh, I stood in line for 5 hours to see, you know, Prometheus. I'm a dork. It's just like you. No, not yet, kid.
I mean, when you say geek, and obviously the name of our show is Movie Geeks United, I mean, I think
right.
the thing that characterizes a geek more than anything is whatever they're obsessed with, that's just it. It's an obsession. It's all-consuming.
Yeah.
And yeah, that tremendous love that we share for movies. I mean, that's we're completely geeky about them. I want to ask you a question, though, about 2001, because I mean, we've been exploring Kubrick on the show for so long, and we talked to the actor that played Moonwatcher. So, I mean, I saw your Moonwatcher, and I got excited. I said, oh, a 2001 guy. That's awesome. But that movie, its ambiguity, its kind of mysteries, the kind of unknowable quality of a lot of it, it completely fascinates me. And I find that it becomes a different viewing experience for me. You know, every time I see it, I discover something new about it because I'm different.
Right.
So I'm curious from you, what does that movie mean to you today?
Well, the movie has actually continued to deepen for me as well, although I formulated my opinions about it fairly early and have stuck with them. In fact, they're expressed fairly well by John Francis Daley's version of me in 52577. I actually think that it's a very knowable film. You know, Kubrick has been variously quoted as saying, you know, if you totally understand the end of the movie, I've failed. You know, But, and again, I don't want to give too much away because I want people to see the movie, but I give a pretty full and complete assessment over the course of 5/25/27 of all the mysterious elements of 2001. I find the movie to be relentlessly fascinating, both about the human condition of you know, Kubrick's basic take on man being a killer ape that really cannot be redeemed, and ultimately is not able to advance to a level where aliens will allow him to ascend to their level, and send, you know, and again I hope people will watch the movie because there's some very fun interpretations of this and some great reactions to it by some of the local characters, the friends that were like, "What the hell are you talking about?" And I think that the section of the movie that gets deeper for me all the time that I like more and more is actually, believe it or not, the Dawn of Man sequence, which a lot of people just think are a bunch of monkeys running around. It's not monkeys, it's Australopithecines, obviously, but the subtlety and the beauty of that sequence, the moment when Moonwatcher first starts thinking about the bone, and when he first even notices it, just that tilt of the head, and I could, you know, there are so many tiny little gestures that Daniel Richter, who played Moonwatcher, obviously, as you said, you had him on the show, and Kubrick worked out together. And I know they must have done, you know, 50 to 100 takes just to get that perfect moment of pure nonverbal communication, you know, in the form of, you know, that's what probably hooked me more than anything as a kid was the nonverbal quality of 2001. There's so much story told through simple actual action, and as you know, Kubrick thinks dialogue is basically superfluous. And if you watch the movie with that in mind, when you, for example, the sequence when the Russian scientists are trying to grill, you know, Haywood Floyd on the space station about what's going on up at the base, you know, at Tycho, there's a bunch of patter and dialogue going on, but under the surface, there are all these other levels of meaning between these characters that is happening. There's really, it's like a dance of subterfuge and emotion and hidden cues to each other, and it's just beautifully done. And it's all done through really Kubrick's fascination with human facial expression and body language, and there's so much to learn about filmmaking in just that scene. In my opinion, right? So I love watching it. Of course, I love the spacecraft. I was fortunate enough to work on the 2010, the sequel, which, whilst not a great movie by any stretch, the idea of working on the sequel to my favorite film of all time and helping to rebuild those spacecraft that had all been destroyed or lost, and you know, after Kubrick was shut down during 2001, and you know, and the models and props were all sent to the incinerator. To be able to work on rebuilding the Discovery was just mind-blowing and just epic. Wow. for a 20-something kid, you know. And I thank Mark Stetson, the visual effects model-making supervisor in 2010, who I was working for as a PA at the time, and he knew that my raison d'etre for being in the film industry at all was, you know, my entire, you know, the whole focus of me being in it was that 2001 had inspired me as a kid. And he said, you know, if you play your cards right, I might be able to get you on 2010. And so I played my cards right, and he got me on 2010.
Wow.
And while, again, I'm not even credited. I was still just, quote-unquote, a PA, but I did more than PA work on that movie.
Well, I remember talking to Peter Himes, and he was talking about actually speaking to Kubrick on the phone pre-production and throughout production, and said it was just amazing to be on talking to someone that I consider to be a deity. I mean, and
yeah.
I mean, George Lucas is the same way. I mean, if you think of the true game changers in film,
yeah.
I mean, Star Wars is as big as it gets. How did you feel yourself kind of changing when you first saw Star Wars?
Well, you have to remember that I first saw Star Wars when it was still in rough cut form at ILM up in the San Fernando Valley by a fluke, a crazy kind of Wizard of Oz-like accident where I was blown out of Wadsworth, Illinois by a tornado named my mother on this magical trip. I don't want to give too much away from the film, but when I first saw Star Wars, it was literally a work print with all the blue screens were still uncomposited. You could still see grips, like, outside the X-Wing cockpits and outside the Millennium Falcon cockpit, you know, doing lighting tricks and rocking the set. And, you know, there were no sound effects, no music. It was World War II footage and stuff from Dam Busters and 633 Squadron. It was all standing in for the dogfight sequences. It was just this big thing that looked like it had been made out of things you could find lying around in your garage. And it inspired me, you know, at the same time on this same magical journey, I got to visit the visual effects facility that was doing Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I met Steven Spielberg for the first time during this scenario and spent the better part of a day with him and the model crew and Douglas Trumbull watching them do cloud tank sequences and all this great stuff. And it struck me as a kid that Close Encounters was an exercise in massive engineering and planning and incredible detail and sort of very, you know, Douglas Trumbull-esque visual effects filmmaking. And, of course, at the time, I wasn't fascinated with directors. I was fascinated with visual effects people. You know, meeting Steven was a big thrill, but I wanted to meet Douglas Trumbull because at the time I didn't even understand just how much responsibility the director had. I was a kid from Wadsworth, Illinois, and yes, I was directing my own movies, but that meant I was just making movies, which meant I did everything. So I didn't have any real separation of director, visual effects man, sound man, you know, actor. I was all those things. So the director to me on a Hollywood film was just, because I didn't know anybody, he was just a guy who got to tell people what to do. I didn't realize how great the responsibility was. To me, the most responsible people or the most important people on the films that I was in love with were the people creating these illusions. So I was fascinated with meeting people like Douglas Trumbull and John Dykstra and those types. And so when I saw the Close Encounters scenario at Future General where Douglas Trumbull was supervising the effects, I thought, this is too big. It's too much. You have to be way too educated and intelligent and engineering oriented. You have to know too much. I'm never going to be able to do this. I was mortified, terrified by what I saw during the making of Close Encounters because it was just so meticulously worked out and planned and engineered, you know. And the facility was like a clean room at NASA, at least comparatively to ILM, because the next day when I went to ILM, it was like a bunch of college kids, these long-haired hippie types with a hot tub made out of a camera case out in the front and racing RC cars around in the parking lot and building stuff out of model kits I had on my own shelves at home. And it literally looked like my basement and my garage at my home in Wadsworth. And it was like, this I can do.
Wow.
This is the kind of thing I can pull off. And I don't have to leave Wadsworth. I can go back to Wadsworth. I can marry my high school sweetheart. I can, you know, stay with my friends forever, and I'll just make movies in my garage, just like George Lucas did with this big garage in the Valley. Star Wars, when you look at it, especially Star Wars, as it was called, because it wasn't episode anything. It was just Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to tell you. Because, you know, people still fight about this. I've seen internet flame wars over whether that's true or not. Anyway, Star Wars to me represented the idea of, you know, the old serials, you know, Flash Gordon, all that, you know, done with a little bit more technology, but not much more, just what was available off the shelf, but utilized in a new way, and taking literally old World War II costumes and putting new stuff on them and you know, just, you know, shells from this or that and turning them into helmets, and just, it was literally like a garage sale movie. It was just this movie that George fashioned and his crew fashioned out of flotsam and jetsam of our regular civilization. Everything in it was something that if you looked at it from a different angle, you'd go, hey, I have one of those. that's my grandma's lamp turned upside down with light bulbs in it. You know, I mean, the whole movie was made out of pieces of Americana. And I
think that's the power of it. I mean, as a storyteller, I mean, he combined all these elements that you're talking about, and he kind of inadvertently he created our new mythology. I mean,
yes,
that's what it is to us today.
It is, and it's because I've always said to people, and I've spent some time with George. I actually, right after Space Invaders came out, Fred Roos, who is one of the producers along with Gary Kurtz on 525/77. wanted to meet me because he saw the movie. The agents at CAA had sent him a copy of the movie. He saw it, and he asked me to lunch, and I was so thrilled to meet the producer of all Francis Coppola's films. And I went to lunch, and I walked in, and I sat down, and Fred's sitting there waiting for me with a cup of coffee. He's stirring it, and he stares at me. I sit at the table, and he stares at me, and he stares at me, stirring his coffee. And this goes on for like 3-4 minutes. He doesn't say anything, and finally taps the spoon, puts it down, takes a sip of the coffee, sits back, stares at me another minute, and then finally says, "Your movie, dollar for dollar, has more production value in it than any film I have ever seen. How did you do this?"
Wow.
And because he was so impressed with what I did on Space Invaders for like $1 million or $1.75 million, he then called George, unbeknownst to me, and set up a breakfast for us, because George at the time was getting ready to do something called Radioland Murders over at Universal. So the next thing I know, I get a call from my agent saying, "George Lucas wants to have breakfast with you." I'm like, "Oh, God!" You know, eyes popping out of my head. And I'm like, I'm going to have a hat. So do I have, just, can my body go and leave my brain at home? Because it's not going to be worth anything. But sure enough, I went and had breakfast at the Bel Air Hotel with George Lucas, which was insane. It was supposed to be like a 15-minute breakfast. And instead, George and I sat and talked about the changing world of film and visual effects and production design and editorial, and how everything was moving slowly towards a digital world, and how he was trying new techniques and new technologies. And the entire time, now you got to remember, Gary Kurtz calls me Fan One, because I, technically, according to his calculations, based on when I saw the rough cut of Star Wars, he says I'm the first person that didn't work on Star Wars to see it.
Wow.
Which means... So he calls me Fan One. I might get a license plate that says that. It's kind of fun. But I don't actually want to covet that. That seems greedy. But if it's true, I'm proud of it, and I'm happy of it. But imagine being a person who fell madly in love with Star Wars, who came back to his hometown and was yapping away about Wookiees and TIE Fighters and X-Wings and Millennium Falcons and Obi-Wan and this and, you know, Jawa's that, and all your friends just looking at it like, "What are you on? Are you
exactly,
what are you talking about?" I mean, it's easy enough to be a Star Wars fanboy now because there's billions of them. But at the time, I was the only one.
Wow, that's incredible.
And nobody believed me. They really thought I was making this up. They thought I came back from this trip to California and had to make up some incredible lie just to make it seem like I saw something cool while I was there. And then, of course, you know, a few months later, they're all yapping about Star Wars and X-Wings and Jawas and, you know, going...
But you were you got there first. Yeah, I
did.
I want to know about your... when you decided to embark on writing the film, you know, this kind of very personal reminiscence of a special time and place. Tell me about the process of writing about your own experience in a way.
Well, what happened? There's two things, and it harkens back to one little additional thing about the George Lucas thing. I did go to that breakfast, and for the next 2 hours instead of 15 minutes, I ended up never once, and I had made a promise to myself that I would do this, that I would never mention the word star and the word wars in the same sentence, ever, during the whole breakfast, and I never did. We never once discussed Star Wars. I didn't even say, "Hey, I love Star Wars." Of course I wouldn't say that. I didn't even want him to think I'd ever seen it, frankly, because I was certain in my mind that George had heard every possible, you know, compliment, every possible, you know, bit of incisive wisdom that every fan had ever had. You know, he's probably heard so much about it that he must be sick of it by now. And I just thought, I mustn't task him with my Star Wars fandom, especially because, frankly, I have a right to say I was there first. So I didn't mention it at all. And then when it was over, as soon as I was leaving, and we had a great time, a great breakfast, really fun, and he's, you know, spoken several times since, and he's been very supportive of this film, I always said, "What an idiot, why didn't you at least say something?" but that harkens to what you're, it goes more to what you're talking about. So for a long time, I buried this fandom. I just put it away because I don't own a collection of Star Wars action figures. I've never dressed up in a stormtrooper outfit. I don't have a lightsaber. I built the Millennium Falcon model once when it first came out, and I didn't even like the model very much. I hated the detail. I didn't think it was accurate. And, you know, so, yeah, you know, so, but my fandom is this quiet knowledge that, you know, I got to see it when it was still in the shape my movie's in right now. You know, I got to see it when George was still struggling, when the effects guys were still, you know, staying up 36 hours a day to try to meet a deadline. And, you know, when it was still this raw, beautiful thing that hadn't found itself yet. It was still, you know, finalizing. There was so much left to be done, you know, the score. And the, and so, anyway, I sublimated my love of Star Wars for so long that right around the time, you know, about 1999, I was basically really sick of Hollywood. I'd had it. I'd had a number of experiences that had really burned me, you know, Dragonheart, Speed Racer, a bunch of scenarios that you can read all about in various articles and things like that. But my experience with the studio system in Hollywood and with the kind of material they were trying to turn my material into was such that I decided, along with, you know, my family, to get the hell out and just not be there. And it's one of those things where some people say, oh, you ran away, you gave up. And I didn't run away and give up. I actually did leave so that I wouldn't give up. I left so that I could get reconnected to the kind of life and place that inspired me in the first place. I mean, I grew up in a town of 750 people with my dad's movie camera, a basement, and a forest and a lake outside, and, you know, some air to breathe, and everything was left in my imagination because there was nothing around. I had a sky full of stars. I had a couple of friends who owned toy guns and army uniforms, and I had some firecrackers, and I had a train set, and I had a movie camera. You know, we went out and made these epic, fantastical things, these, you know, Planet of the Apes redos and Jaws 2, and, you know, I made Jaws 2 before the real Jaws 2 was done. And what happened was, I didn't know it at the time, but moving back to, literally, to the neighborhood I grew up in, I think was because I just needed to reconnect to that energy. And that energy was, you know, suffused through 52577. You know, when I got back there, as I started to reconnect to that energy of being in these, you know, these dusty country roads and the sunsets that last forever and fireflies and skies full of stars and, you know, that I used to imagine were full of UFOs coming to take me back to where I was actually born, you know, as that seeped into me, I suddenly realized one day that there was this movie waiting to get out that I had, the story I had told many friends and relatives and over time, but I'd never really thought about telling as a film. And when I told Gary Kurtz the story, he said, well, this is the film you should be making. I mean, you've got all these other things in development, you're working on all these other things, but this is clearly the most potent moment in your life, you know, the most critical turning point in your existence. And I realized that, you know, like my favorite George Lucas film to this day is still American Graffiti. Close second is actually THX-1138. They go back and forth depending on my mood. And Star Wars, which I love, and obviously was a turning point for me, you know, I saw 28 times in this movie theater its opening run. But had THX-1138 been out at a time when I could have driven myself to the theater, I probably would have sat through that a million times. I absolutely I'm obsessed with that film. And American Graffiti came out as a real turning point for me. I think I was 12 or 13 years. I guess I was 13 when it came out, and it really struck home. And I'd always wanted to do a film like that, but I never thought about the fact that the film that I wanted to do like that and the experience of the whole Star Wars connection could be melded into one story. It just didn't occur to me, and it should have. And when it finally did, I said, I basically, this was like 1999 or 2000, I started writing the script. I just started noodling around with it, kind of afraid of it, to be honest, because it, on the surface, it while a lot of people think, oh, fanboys, it's going to be another, you know, when Fanboys was made, Ernie Cline is a friend, and I read the original script and loved it. But what he was trying to do, and in fact what he was trying to do with the original script was a little bit closer, I think, than what the film ended up being. Although, you know, I enjoyed Fanboys a lot. It's just a very different road. It's you know, it's obviously it's post Star Wars, and it's modern and very satirical. Obviously, whereas this film is much, much more a human drama with a lot of funny stuff in it. It's much more American Graffiti on the night Star Wars came out than it is any kind of a send-up of anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's very, very little parody. In fact, there's no real parody in it other than that which I did, for comedic effect as a kid, you know what I mean? Any kind of playing around I did. But it's all about leaving home. So in a way,
yeah.
I had to go home to make a film about leaving home.
Huh.
And it was fascinating to go back there and soak up these places and meet up with many of the people that are portrayed in the movie who still live back there, some of whom are actually do cameos in the movie as adult characters now. I don't want to give those away yet because they're kind of fun surprises. And then even some of the people I went to high school with that I had made movies with in high school who went on to also become professional filmmakers or film crew members. Dawn Ferry, our production designer, was an artist in high school that I hung out with, and she went on to be a successful production designer, and we kind of never really worked together. We just knew each other and were childhood friends, and then when it was time to do this movie, it was like Return of the Alumni. You know, she came back, and a bunch of other people that I went to high school with that had done various things in film and theater came back and helped make this beautiful little film about a time we all remembered together. And it was, I think, just, it was my disenchantment with Hollywood in general that made me, you know, go back and rediscover what it was that made me try to get to Hollywood in the first place. So it's been this weird full circle loop. And I've often even struggled with the ending of the movie, which I don't want to give away, but when you see it, you'll understand why there's an interesting dilemma presented by the end of the film. And that, I don't want to say too much more than that, but I think people, once they see it, will get what I meant by that.
Well, it had to have been, I would imagine, when you're shooting it, a very emotional, cathartic experience.
You know, there were moments that were, I have to tell you, though, it was such hard work. We had so little time and so few resources and wanted to achieve so much with so little of it that it was really, the emotional cathartic experience was writing it and then, mm-hmm. and then post-shooting it, the editorial process and the discovery of magical moments in it that some of which were planned, some of which weren't, and some of which were created out of things that were never meant to be what they are now. And also watching what John Francis Daley and the other actors, especially John, what he did with capturing a version of me that, if you believe in quantum mechanics, is still back there living this life as we speak, who wouldn't recognize me. He's the person I am now. But he captured something and interpreted something by observing me. John came late to the party. It was actually originally going to be Haley Joel Osment playing me, and then there were disagreements about money that blew that up in the last few days before shooting, and suddenly we were without a lead actor and we could not delay shooting or the movie would completely fall apart. And so what ended up happening was we literally, you know, the name John Francis Daley came up, and I thought, what, the little guy from Freaks and Geeks? He's like 9 years old. And someone said, that was 10 years ago. Here's what he looks like now. And I looked and I said, wow, he looks spectacularly nothing like me. Perfect. Let's call him. So we called him, sent him the script. He read it. He loved it. We talked on the phone. We got along fine, but we didn't meet till the night before the first day of shooting when he came to his wardrobe. He flew in and got his, you know, wardrobe measured and got his wig fitted. That was the first time we met, so we had no time at all to discuss this character. And I refer to it as this character because I could not go through the movie saying, well, it's me, or I would have done this, or I would have done. It's not how I looked at it. I really had to treat it as a separate person. John took the, without telling me or anyone else, what I've realized, having looked at all the footage and the performances, what he did was he came in not knowing anything and immediately set about observing me as an adult and also talking to people who knew me as a kid. But he watched me. When the other kids would go take a break, you know, and, you know, go get a snack or go hang out and laugh it up or play the guitar or something between takes, John would often be just lurking, watching me. And I didn't know this, and I didn't realize it. Somebody pointed it out later that they had seen him doing it. But the way I really found out that this was true was by seeing little gestures and little things vocally and little, just little demonstrations of me, the person, that no one else who didn't know me would notice, but he thought it was important. And because of it, there were, for me, emotional moments in the editing room where I saw him do things that were literally only things that I would know were important. But they hit me hard because I can remember these moments, because everything in the film, with a couple of exceptions, but not many, everything major in the film really did happen. And the dialogue is pretty much word for word for what happened. So to have written this and then to see it performed is one thing, but then to go back and actually be able to steep in it and watch it and then quietly sitting in an editing room, see some of the choices that people like John made, it was profound. There were some really deeply moving moments there.
Well, I think about, you know, there's one way of looking at the films that a director makes, and maybe you look at your films like this too. Maybe you look back and you say, okay, this is who I was then when I made this movie, that this serves as some kind of signpost of this is who I was then. But when you did this film and you've gone back and you've tinkered here and there, has your perception of the movie or the kind of changes you want to make in the movie, has that evolved over the years based upon where you are today as opposed to where you were when you made it? That's a very convoluted question, but do you understand it?
No, but I get it. It's convoluted, but so is the process, so it's a perfect question. It's like it interlocks like the teeth of gears in a watchworks. The truth is, you know, when I first made the movie, I wanted to capture the simple, pure passion of filmmaking versus the pure passion of love, first love, and which one wins if you have to choose between them, and how dangerous choosing either one of those things is for a frail young soul, you know, for a teenager. A teenager presented with life choices that will take them either towards their ultimate dream or towards what they suspect ought to be their fate with a person or a place that they expect to spend the rest of their lives with. That choice, that dilemma of can you make that choice, and or is there a way to bring them together? Can you have both? I want to, and you know, that pure yearning, painful, dreaming, wishing, literally sitting outside and wishing on stars at sunset every night that you could become this thing that you believe you had the ability to do if you could just get the chance. And at the same time, wishing to connect with another person and a place and build a family out of the pieces of humanity that surround you as a child, you know, especially when you come from a broken family, as I did. So it was all about that pure, that passion. And then over time, as the exigencies of production and the difficulties of trying to capture everything you wanted and sometimes getting it, sometimes not, you know, come into play, and you start to make compromises in certain moments, and then you compromise because of money, and you compromise because somebody is worried about this or that, and this financier or this representative wants, you start to get gummed up, and there's too many cooks, and everything is muddy, and there's too many ingredients, and then after watching the film over and over and over, certain scenes that used to crackle with energy seem leaden and boring, and you start to add tricks. You start to do, you know, montages and interesting cross cuts and cool transitions, and pretty soon it's about adding some effect to add something in the distance or make those clouds look cooler, and you're just working the clay until it's just a big muddle. It's just you end up overcutting, and because, you know, when a scene is good, it's only good for a few viewings. But if you've seen it 20 times, even if it's great, you don't know it's great anymore. So for a little while there, because of the problems of getting finished, in trying to find out ways to help it get finished, I was sometimes getting in my own way and actually cutting to death certain moments. But then I was away from it for almost 2 years, where I really didn't look at it. I had other work to do. I had to earn a living. I had to support my children. I had to live a life and move on to do other things while knowing I would ultimately get 52577 finished and out. by being away that long, I grew as a human being. I grew as a filmmaker doing other things and as a writer. The writing is the key to everything, in my opinion. It always has been, always will be. You know, Thalberg said it, you know, and he was right. The writer is the most important person in Hollywood, and he must never find out. And they have tried for years to keep that us from knowing that, but it is true. The words are ultimately everything, unless you're Stanley Kubrick. And even then, his words, while he calls them superfluous, they are designed, and they are written, and there is a reason. Nobody can say that, you know, words weren't important to something like, you know, Dr. Strangelove, for example.
Right.
You know,
right.
The words were everything in that movie. But I've had time to go back now and go, okay, now you're just pulling tricks out of your bag here in this sequence. And in this sequence, you're just trying to, you're showing off here, and you're trying to be visually clever here because you're afraid that the simple moment of him talking to his friend at a gas station on a summer night doesn't hold enough weight in today's modern, you know, Michael Bay-esque filmmaking culture. I've realized that's not the case, and audiences have been helping you figure this out more recently. People, it's a very non-cynical film, and it's easy to take a non-cynical film and get cynical about it yourself and start putting cynical things in it to try to anticipate the cynicism of the audience. Well, the audience is getting sick of cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
We had a run. I think people really like honesty and earnestness and simple, you know, excitement again. I think they're in the mood for that, and this movie has that, and I'm starting to pare back and go back to what I call, you know, 525-77 unplugged. I'm recutting towards a more American Graffiti-esque innocence, because it was an innocent time. It was very innocent, and I was incredibly innocent, and to try to be too ahead of the game and too hip to my own fan one status or any of that nonsense, or trying to, you know, give the audience a kind of, you know, tricky, cool. It's like the Grindhouse films that got done. You know, the Grindhouse thing. I'm a fan of these guys, all these directors. But my problem with that thing was that they took if it had been me and a bunch of my filmmaking buddies, if we were that successful and famous, which we're not, but if we were, I still would have said, let's give ourselves each $50,000 to make a movie, not $5-10 million a piece or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right.
What a Grindhouse film really should cost, instead of spending all this money and all this technology and all this work to make a big budget movie and then, you know, degrade it with, you know, splices and dirt and scratch marks, just try making the best possible, you know, gigantic epic action movie you can with $50,000. You're a talented filmmaker. Whatever you come up with will be awesome, but it'll be really awful at the same time. And that's what you want.
Yeah.
And in my case, I've worked on movies that cost $50 million. Baby's Day Out was a $50 million movie, and I had a much better time, and I think got a much better movie out of a movie I made for, you know, $2.5 million with 525-77, because I was forced to do what I could with character, with dialogue, and everything else was whatever I could throw at it. But even that is never going to look like Transformers. We don't have those kinds of effects. Our effects, in fact, are at a stage right now where they're sort of what I call high-quality temp for the most part. Some of them are still low-quality temp because they were put in last minute to get into various festivals, and they just have never been finished. And it's a kind of a fun way to see the movie because we know they're going to be finished by the time it's released. And right now you get to kind of see the wires, you know, and
right.
see the edge of the set. And some people, when it's over at Q&As, I've said, look, you know, don't worry about the effects. We're going to fix all those up before it comes out. But people are like, no. Why? No, don't. They're like, no, that's what's wonderful. This movie feels like it's something this kid made in his garage. And I'm like, aha, we're on to something. You know,
I think that's
like,
what they're responding
like,
to. I think that's what they're responding to, and you're talking about it. I think it's the purity. I mean, that's what they're latching onto, the purity of it, I think.
Well, that's exactly right. And, in fact, I'm kicking myself because there was a time where I had said I don't want to use any computer graphics of any kind in this movie because they didn't exist back then. I want to do it all with miniatures, everything. And even if it looks like a miniature, that's okay. And there's even a couple of sequences we may yet go back and throw out the motion graphics that we did and take this little model Pinto, for example, and have it going down the road, you know, on a wire, you know, just the way we would have done it in 1977, because it's okay. You go back and look at some of my favorite movies as a kid. You look at things like Sink the Bismarck, you know, with black and white movie, 1950, whatever, six or whatever they made it, and it's miniatures in a studio tank somewhere in England, you know, with just... They're miniatures. They're big miniatures. They're nice miniatures. They blow up real good, but they're miniatures, and it doesn't matter because it's the story. When I was doing Dragonheart, and the Henson Creature Shop built this amazing dragon for us, full-size, audio-animatronic, talking dragon. It was just beautiful, and I'm going to be releasing some footage on that soon. I'll tell you about that later. With our test and the night that we had, the Dragon Slayer that we had working with him was this young unknown actor named Clive Owen at the time.
Wow. Yeah.
So anyway, when we did this, everybody was freaking out because, you know, Universal, all the executives were like, no, because they just seen Jurassic Park and they're like, we got to do it CG. And I said, why? It's going to cost $180 million to do Dragonheart the way they did Jurassic Park. It can't be done. We're not in the budget you have. And I knew all the guys at ILM, and they said, yeah, we can do Dragonheart if you have literally like $180 million for effects and 7 years to do it, you know. And I said to them, I said, let me ask you guys a question. What did you think of E.T.? They said, oh, E.T. is the greatest movie ever, blah, blah, blah. Okay, good. Uh-huh. What did you think of the puppet, of Carlo Rambaldi's puppet? And they're like, oh, it's the greatest thing ever. I said, it's really not the greatest thing ever. I said, what it is it's imbued with the belief in the faces of these children that Stephen directed in such a way and infused with such belief in this creature that because they believe it, you believe it. Because if you really look and you turn off the sound and you cut out Drew Barrymore and Henry Thomas and you just look at the puppet alone, it's got seams. It jiggles and wobbles. It doesn't. It's not the world's greatest puppet. It's a beautiful piece of work, but is it the world's most perfect illusion? Is it a CG quality illusion, or in terms of seamlessness? No, it's puppeteering. It's magic. It's performance above all, and right. Performance is far more important than reality. You know, the Muppets don't look real. You can see the rods coming out of them, and they make no mistake. They don't take them out. They could, but there's no reason to. The audience doesn't care.
Because
the performance.
It's the context that surrounds them that makes them feel real.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I argued that the dragon, and this was when I was going to make it with Sean Connery. I already had Sean Connery, and I was going to make it with Liam Neeson as the knight, which... The idea of Liam and Sean together, and Liam was working on this with me. We were developing the script together, and this was a year before Schindler's List, and the studio was like, Liam Neeson? Oh, God, no, he's never going to amount to anything. It's like, okay, fine. If he's not doing it, I'm not doing it. And they said, okay, fine, you're not doing it. My own project. But anyway, it's an age-old argument. You know, you can't fight people who get fascinated with technology when they're missing the point. You know, there's no. When you see the footage of this Henson dragon, you'll say, of course, yes, it's a big audio animatronic puppet dragon, but its performance is so cool and so wonderful that you just go, I want to watch this. I could watch a whole movie of this. Mm. You know, whereas I found that the dragon in Dragonheart ultimately, I mean, Phil Tippett did an amazing job on creating the best CG dragon ever created at that point, and it's a great. You know, it's wonderful, except, you know, Sean Connery, who I love, was basically just being Sean Connery, for example. I had wanted him to be this sort of animalistic Sean Connery. It wasn't that it was supposed to be a dragon that had swallowed James Bond. The idea was that it would be this creature that could barely choke out human language, like a, humans, you know, you know, something living and breathing and part of a dragon, you know? Hello there, hi, I'm James Bond inside a dragon body. Like a martini with this lance, you know?
That's a great impression, by the way. That's very good.
Thank you very much.
We have just a couple of minutes left of recording time, so I want to make sure that I can tell our audiences how they can find your movie and what the future plans are. You're screening in Austin Friday. Are there screenings scheduled beyond that point?
We are screening Friday at ND in Austin at 7:00. The doors open at 6:30. It's free. This is a test screening. What we're doing is we're going across the country test screening the movie to determine the final cut, because there's been this push-pull, as I told you, of a lot of people trying to get different things in and out of the movie. And now that I've sort of seized control of the film again, I'm pulling it back to what I think it needs to be. But I really want the audience's help on this. And so since there is this want-to-see factor of people who've been aware of the film, there's a fan base out there. We're inviting them to invite us. So basically, we're heading from Austin through the Southwest, off towards, Roswell, New Mexico, Meteor Crater, and Lake Powell, and everything in between, the Route 66 kind of route. And one second, please. Just had an alarm go off. So we're heading through the Southwest, and basically we're kind of doing a kind of, hey, if you hear we're coming your way and want us to stop, get enough people to show up and tell us if they want to be there, or go to heartsofdarkness.com and click on Keep Us Rolling and make a donation, and we may just come your way and set up a screening in your backyard, for that matter. I mean, we're really interested in doing this, not just in theaters and music venues, and we've done a couple of comic book shops, which was great. We did Krypton Comics and Time Warp Comics, Krypton in Omaha, and Krypton in Boulder. No? I'm sorry. Krypton in Omaha. Sorry, I'm getting my comic book shops confused. So we did Krypton Comics in Omaha and Time Warp Comics in Boulder. In both places, it was a blast. We just set up a screen in the back of the store amongst all the Star Wars figures and comic books and stuff, and had popcorn and pizza and watched this movie with fans. And it was terrific, and we got a lot of really great insights from these folks. And so we're basically saying, let us know where you are if you're interested, and if anywhere near our path, we'll come by and we'll show it. If you get enough people together and you make a good sizable donation, seriously, we'll show it in your parents' basement if you want. I mean, I'm not kidding. We want, and then we'll hang out afterwards and go grab some burgers and talk about it. We're not trying to Hollywoodize this. We're trying to de-Hollywoodize it. We're trying to get right front and center with people and hang out and talk about this whole process of being a geek and committing so much to something, because obviously the people that are still standing on this film are committed to it. And being a geek is a real commitment as well. I mean, you're up against it. There's a lot of people that want to beat you up for it. Although that's not so much true anymore. But I mean, I was a very lonely guy when I was fan one, and now it's funny because I kind of hide my royal blood, my connection to the beginning of it, because I almost feel like, gee, it's not my place. There's a whole apparatus in place now. I mean, I don't have a little slavery outfit I can throw on. Which would probably be the scariest thing you've ever seen, actually. Be like an Ugnaught wearing a Slave Leia outfit, but anyway.
But you guys do want to release this at the end of the year? Is that what you're looking at, or?
We're hoping. Yeah, we're actually in talks with three distributors right now, and they're all making their sort of overtures towards the film. When there was a time when you had work to do to finish a film, and distributors would say, here's $500,000, here's $1 million, finish your movie. Now they're not doing that so much. The economy doesn't allow for it. The distributors aren't the same kind of businesses they once were. And what we're finding is we've got four or five that are interested, but three very seriously interested that are quite well-known distributors. And the problem is they just don't want to pay to finish it. They're like, we will put this in, a couple hundred theaters to start, or even 1,000 theaters to start, platform it, but we want you to finish it first. So basically we're trying to raise that money to finish the movie. And this is part of this journey, is to raise awareness of the film enough to gather enough attention that people, investors, think, well, you know what, it's worth it. There's an audience for this film out there. At the same time, it's also, you know, Ray Bradbury just passed away a few days ago, as I'm sure you're aware. And Ray had become a friend after I had interviewed him a few years ago when we were out in L.A. doing some reshoots for 52577. He grew up in Waukegan, Illinois, which is the town featured in my movie where the Genesee Theater, where I saw Star Wars. He's a hometown hero, and I had always wanted to meet him. And when I was out doing these reshoots, my hometown library of Waukegan, Illinois, and asked if we could go over to Ray's house, since he was getting on in years, and just get some footage of his thoughts and ruminations on life, the universe, and everything. And so we took our camera crew over there and spent 3 amazing hours with Ray in his home. And when I first walked in the door to meet him for the first time, he was sitting in his den filled with posters and paintings and his Ray Harryhausen dinosaurs and all the things that he loves. And he couldn't see me as I walked in, and his assistant said, Patrick Johnson is here to see you, and here's Ray, and I hear his voice go, Patrick Reed Johnson? What does this mean? I'd never met him or even spoken to him before. And I said, yes, like I was bowing before the Wizard of Oz or something. And he goes, the Patrick Reed Johnson that wrote Dragonheart? And I said, well, co-wrote it with Chuck Pope. And he said, would you do an old man a favor and give me an autographed copy of that? That's one of my favorite films.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Tears, you know. And that was my introduction to one of my childhood heroes. And part of this journey when we started it was that we were going to visit Ray and deliver a copy of this film to him. It's kind of a surprise and homage. He's mentioned in the movie, and he certainly helped inspire me to become a writer in the first place. And obviously, he's not going to see it now. Although, if anyone can see my movie posthumously, I think Ray Bradbury is the one who could do it. But he's out there somewhere. But the other, there was also what we call the three wise men in California that we are meant to deliver this movie to. And I'm not going to tell you their names, but I bet you can figure out at least 2 of them.
Yes.
2 of the wise men who are aware of the film but have never seen it are going to receive copies whether they like it or not.
Oh, wow.
We're going to visit.
That'll be terrific. I would love to hear a reaction
The thing is, you'll be able to see it because part of this journey is there's a documentary being made called Hearts of Dorkness, a filmmaker's Odyssey, Odyssey. And Morgan Flores and Colin Thomas and Donald Revelinsky and Ed Murphy and a good guy named James Gillette, who just did a great documentary called The Shark Is Still Working that's going to be on the Jaws Blu-ray release, are all following me in this crazy RV we call Large Marge and with a camera car, and they're basically making a documentary, Hearts of Darkness, about the journey that this film has taken and this final push to get it finished. And so part of that documentary is obviously to record the reactions of the three wise men as we approach them with this movie that means that they're part of and that they inspired. And, you know, and to raise awareness for people to please, please, please go to our fundraiser.com site. And you know, so we're on the front page. They've taken us under our wing, or their wing. They seem to have fallen in love with our project, and we're really delighted that they like us so much. It's fundraiser.com, FundraZR.com. And we're on the front page right now. I think, in fact, there's an article coming out about it. It's like a front page article that they're going to do, which is very exciting. And tomorrow, I think that comes out. And they're geeks over there too, and they sort of saw our little project and said, oh, we love this, and just started promoting it, and it's kind of taken off. And we're just looking to get the gas money to keep going, city to city. And that's what has happened is every single place we've gone, from Devil's Tower to Boulder to now to Austin, we've been sort of stuck somewhere, and then all of a sudden people get wind of what's going on, and boom, we get enough money to go to the next town. And it's a little bit like the circus. But that's the way filmmaking really kind of maybe ought to be. It's really fun. It's adventurous. It's risky, but it's alive, you know. It's not pre-masticated bullshit.
Yeah, like, I agree with you. I mean, the story of this film and what you're doing with it is very inspiring to me. And I know that it's going to be the same thing for our listeners because it's all about, you know, a shared experience. So I think that anything
that promotes that is one. That's the magic of movies right there.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we're at a stage right now in filmmaking history where the audience, instead of sitting there waiting for what's going to get dumped on them every year, especially in the summer or all year long, instead of just sitting around waiting for it, they actually have a voice in it. And not just a mob voice of just sort of pointing the needle in this direction or that, but just a very specific voice with the internet and with things like Tug.com, where you can program your local theater with things you want to see, with Fundraiser and Kickstarter and all of these things. I mean, I foresee a time when filmmakers can simply say, look, did you like my last movie? Good. Then fund my next one. Let's go. We're all in this together. You're all the investors. I'm going to make – here are the five scripts I'd like to do. You guys pick and fund it. Whichever one gets the most money, you all agree that's where the money's going. And, by the way, here's my list of actors I like. Who do you like for these parts? I'm not saying that we turn filmmaking into just this kind of thing by a giant committee, but I am saying – that if a filmmaker can talk directly to the people who like, you know, there's a lot of people who do not like Space Invaders. There's a lot of people who do not like Angus or Baby's Day Out or Dragonheart or When Good Ghouls Go Bad or my episode of Dinosaurs, the TV series, or any of that. There's plenty of them. But there are people who also love those things. And to those people, I say, look, if you want more of that kind of stuff, I can do it. Let's go do it together. You tell me what you want, and we'll go make it.
I guess it's like everyone sees it and everyone likes it, then I won't be the only geek in town anymore.
To everybody else, movies are something to do when you're tired of real life. To you, real life is something to do when you're tired of watching movies.
Don't say you're going to try and then chicken out. If anybody's guess, it might be.
Hollywood might be a door, might be a wall. I don't know until I touch it. The Death Star could take out the Enterprise with one shot.
The Enterprise has deflector shields!